Svort Hendrik's initial descent in the earth was the first time in his life that he had been frightened witless. Unable to speak or think, so terrified that he could not even scream or struggle against it. The terror began when he was in the long line of black miners, each of them wearing black rubber gumboots and grey overalls, the unpainted silver helmets on their heads fitted with head lanterns. Hendrik shuffled forward in the press of bodies down the ramp between the poles of the crush, like cattle entering an abattoir, stopping and starting forward again. Suddenly, he found himself at the head of the line, standing before the steel mesh gate that guarded the entrance to the shaft. Beyond the mesh, he could see the steel cables hanging into the shaft, like pythons with shining scales, and over him towered the steel skeleton of the headgear. When he looked up, he could see the huge wheels silhouetted against the sky 100 feet above his head, spinning and stopping and reversing. Suddenly the mesh gates crashed open, and he was carried on the surge of black bodies into the cage beyond. They packed, shoulder to shoulder, 70 men. The doors closed, the floor dropped under his feet and stopped again immediately. He heard the tramp of feet over his head and looked up, realizing that the skip was a double-decker, and that another 70 men were being packed into the top compartment. Again he heard the clash of closing mesh gates, and he started as the telegraph shrilled, 4 long rings, the signal to descend. And the skip fell away under him, but this time accelerating so violently that his body seemed to come free and his feet lay only lightly on the steel floor plates. His belly was sucked up against his ribs and his terror was unleashed. In darkness, the skip rocketed downwards, drumming and rattling and racing like an express train in a tunnel, and the terror went on, minute after minute, eternity after eternity. He felt himself suffocating, crushed by the thought of the enormous weight of rock above him, his ears popping and crackling at the pressure, a mile and then another mile, straight down into the earth. The skip stopped so abruptly that his knees buckled and he felt the flesh of his face sucked down from the bones of his skull, stretching like rubber. The gates crashed open and he was carried out into the main haulage, a cavern walled with glistening wet rock, filled with men, hundreds of men like rats in a sewer, streaming away into the endless tunnels that honeycombed the bowels of the world. Everywhere there was water, glistening and shining in the flat glare of the electric light, running back in channels on each side of the haulage, squelching under his feet, hidden water drumming and rustling in the darkness or dripping from the jagged roof. The very air was heavy with water, humid and hot and claustrophobic, so that it had a gelatinous texture, seeming to fill his eardrums and deafen him, trickling sluggishly into his lungs like treacle. And his terror lasted all that long march along the drive until they reached the stopes. Here the men split into their separate gangs and disappeared into the shadows. The stopes were the vast open chambers from which the gold-bearing ore had already been excavated, the hanging wall above supported now by packed pillars of shoring timber, the foot wall under them inclined upwards at an angle following the run of the reef. The men of his gang trudged ahead of him, led Hendrik to his station, and here, under a bare electric bulb, waited for the white shift boss, a burly Afrikaner flanked by his 2 boss boys. The station was a 3-sided chamber in the rock, its number on the entrance. There was a long bench against the back wall of the station, and a latrine, its open bucket screened by sheets of burlap. The gang sat on the bench while the boss boys called the roll, and then the white shift boss asked in Fanacolo, "Where is the new hammer boy?" And Hendrik rose to his feet. Cronje, the shift boss, came to stand in front of him. Their eyes were on a level. Both big men. The shift boss's nose was crooked, broken long ago in a forgotten brawl, and he examined Hendrik carefully, He saw the broken gap in his teeth and the scars upon his head, and his respect was tentative and grudging. They were both hard, tough men, recognizing it in each other. Up there in the sunshine and sweet, cool airs, they were black man and white man. Down here in the earth, they were simply men. "You know the hammer?" Cronje asked in Fanacolo. "I know it," Hendrik replied in Afrikaans. He had practiced working the hammer for 2 weeks in the surface training pits. Cronje blinked and then grinned to acknowledge the use of his own language. "I run the best gang of rockbreakers on the CRC," he said, still grinning. "You will learn to break rock, my friend, or I will break your head and your ass instead. Do you understand?" "I understand," Hendrik grinned back at him. And Cronje raised his voice. "All hammer boys here." They stood up from the bench. 5 of them, all big men like Hendrik. It took tremendous physical strength to handle the jackhammers. They were the elite of the rock-breaking gangs, earning almost double wages and bonus for footage, earning also immense prestige from lesser men. Cronje wrote their names up on the blackboard under the electric bulb. Henry de Barker at the bottom of the list, and Zama, the big Zulu, at 1. When Zama stripped off his jacket and tossed it to his line boy, his great black muscles bulged and gleamed in the stark electric light. "Ha!" he looked at Hendrik. "So, we have a little Ovambo jackal coming yipping from the desert." The men around him laughed obsequiously. Zama was top hammer on the section. Everybody laughed when he made a joke. "I thought that the Zulu baboon scratched his fleas only on the peaks of the Drakensberg, so his voice can be heard afar," Hendrik said quietly. And there was a shocked silence for a moment, and then a guffaw of disbelieving laughter. "All right, you two big talkers," Cronje intervened. "Let's break some rock." He led them from the station, up the stope, to the rock face, where the gold reef was a narrow, grey, horizontal band in the jagged wall, dull and nondescript, without the faintest precious sparkle. The gold was locked away in it. The roof was low. A man had to double over to reach the face. But the stope was wide, reaching away hundreds of metres into the darkness on either hand. And they could hear the other gangs out there along the rock face, their voices echoing and reverberating, their lanterns throwing weird shadows. "Tabaka," Cronje yelled, "here." He had marked the shot holes to be drilled with splashes of white paint, indicating the inclination and depth of each hole. The blast was a precise and calculated firing of gelignite charges. The outer holes would be charged with shapers to form the hanging wall and footwall of the slope. They would fire first, while the pattern of inner shots fired a second later. These were the cutters that would kick the ore back and clear it from the face. "Shire!" Cronje yelled at Hendrik. "Hit it!" And lingered a second to watch as Hendrik stooped to the drill. It squatted on the rock floor in front of the face, an ungainly tool in the shape of a heavy machine gun, with long pneumatic hoses attached to it and running back down the slope to the compressed air system in the main haulage. Swiftly, Hendrik fitted the 20-foot-long steel jumper bit into the lug of the drill, and then he and his line boy dragged the tool to the rock face. It took all the strength of both Hendrik and his assistant to lift the tool and position the point of the drill on the white paint mark for the first cut. Hendrik eased himself into position behind the tool, taking the full weight of it on his right shoulder. The line boy stepped back, and Hendrik opened the valve. The din was stunning. a stuttering implosion of sound that drove in against the eardrums as compressed air at a pressure of 500 pounds a square inch roared into the drill and slammed the long steel bit into the rock. Hendrick's entire body shuddered and shook to the drive of the tool against his shoulder, but still he leaned his full weight against it. His head jumped on the thick corded column of his neck so rapidly that his vision blurred. But he narrowed his eyes and aimed the point of the drill into the rock at the exact angle that the shift boss had called for. Water squirted down the hollow steel drill, bubbling out of the hole in a yellow mist, splattering into Hendrick's face. The sweat burst from his black skin, running down his face as though he was standing under a cloudburst, mingling with the slimy mud pouring down his naked back and scattering like rain as his training muscles fluttered and jumped to the impulse of the pounding steel drill at his shoulder. Within minutes, the entire surface of his body began to itch and burn. It was the hammer boy's affliction. His skin was being scrubbed back and forth 1,000 times a minute by the violent shaking motion of the drill. And with each minute, the agony became more intense. He tried to close his mind to it, but still it felt as though a blowtorch was being played over his body. The long steel drill sank slowly into the rock until it reached the depth marker painted on it, and Hendrick closed the valve. There was no silence, for even though his hearing was dulled, as though his eardrums were filled with cotton wool, yet he could still hear the echoes of the drill thunder resounding against the roof of his skull. The line boy ran forward, seized the jumper bit, and helped him withdraw it from the first shot hole, and repositioned the tip on the second daubed paint mark. Once again, Hendrick opened the valve, and the din and the agony began again. However, gradually the itching burn of his body blurred into numbness, and he felt disembodied, as though cocaine had been injected under his skin. So he stood to the rock all that shift, 6 hours without let or relief. When it ended, and they trooped back from the face, splattered and coated with yellow mud from head to foot, and weary beyond pain or feeling, even Zama, the great black Zulu, was reeling on his feet, and his eyes were dull. In the station, Cronje wrote the total of work completed against their names on the blackboard. Zama had drilled 16 patterns, Hendrick 12, and the next best man 10. "How?" Zama muttered, as they rode up to the surface in the crowded skip. "On his very first shift, the jackal is number 2 hammer." And Hendrick had just enough strength to reply, "And on his second shift, the jackal will be top hammer." It never happened. Not once did he break more rock than the Zulu. But at the end of that first month, as Hendrick sat in the company beer hall with the other Ovambos of the Buffalo Totem gathered around him, the Zulu came to his table carrying 2 1-gallon jugs of the creamy, effervescent millet beer that the company sold its men. It was thick as porridge and just as nutritious, though only very mildly alcoholic. Zama set a 1-gallon jug down in front of Hendrick and said, "We broke some rock together this month, hey, Jackal?" "And we'll break a lot more together next month, hey, baboon?" Hendrick replied. And they both roared with laughter and raised the beer jugs in unison and drank them dry. Zama was the first Zulu to become initiated into the Brotherhood of the Buffaloes. Not as natural as it sounded, for tribal barriers, like mountain ranges, were difficult to cross. It was 3 months before Hendrick saw his brother again. But by that time, Hendrick had extended his influence throughout the entire compound of black mine workers at the CRC mine property. With Zama as his lieutenant, The buffaloes now encompassed men from many different tribes, Zulus and Shangaans and Matabeles. The only criterion was that the new initiates should be hard, reliable men, preferably with some influence over at least a section of the 8,000-odd black miners, and preferably also appointed by the mine administration to positions of authority on the property, clerks or boss boys or company police. Some of the men who were approached resisted the Brotherhood's overtures. One of these, a senior Zulu boss boy with 30 years' service and a misplaced sense of duty to his tribe and the company, fell into one of the ore chutes on the 60th level of the main haulage the day after he refused. His body was ground to a muddy paste by the tons of jagged rock that rumbled over it. It seemed that nobody had witnessed the accident. One of the company police in Dunas, who also resisted the blandishments of the Brotherhood, was found stabbed to death in his sentry box at the main gates to the property, while yet another was burned to death in the kitchens. Three buffaloes witnessed this last unfortunate incident caused by the victim's own clumsiness and inattention, and there were no more refusals. When at last the messenger came from Moses, identifying himself with the secret sign and hand clasp, he bore a summons to a meeting, and Hendrik was able to leave the mine property without check. By government decree, the black mine workers were strictly confined within the barbed wire fences of the compounds. It was the opinion of both the Chamber of Mines and the Johannesburg City Fathers that to let tens of thousands of single black males roam the goldfields at will would invite disaster. They had the salutary lesson of the Chinese before them. In 1904, almost 50,000 Chinese coolies had been brought into South Africa to fill the huge shortage of unskilled labour for the gold mines. However, the Chinese were much too intelligent and restless to be confined to compounds and restricted to unskilled labour, and they were highly organised in their secret Tong societies. The result was a wave of lawlessness and terror that swept over the goldfields, rapine and robbery, gambling and drugs, so that in 1908, at huge cost, all the Chinese were rounded up and shipped home. The government was determined to avoid a repetition of this terror, and the compound system was strictly enforced. However, Hendrik passed through the gates of the CRC compound as though he were invisible. He crossed the open veldt in the starlight until he found the overgrown track and followed it to the old abandoned shaft head. There, parked behind the deserted rusting corrugated iron shed, was a black Ford sedan. And as Hendrik approached it cautiously, the headlights were switched on, spotlighting Hendrik, and he froze. Then the lights were switched off, and Moses' voice called out of the darkness, "I see you, my brother." They embraced impulsively, and then Hendrik laughed. "Ha! So you drive a motor car now, like a white man." "The motor car belongs to Bom Vu," Moses said, and led him to it. And Hendrik sank back against the leather seat and sighed comfortably. "This is better than walking." "Now tell me, Hendrik, my brother," said Moses, "what has happened at CRC?" And Moses listened without comment until Hendrik finished his long report. Then he nodded. "You have understood my wants," he said. "It is exactly as I wished it. The Brotherhood must take in men from all the tribes, not just the Ovambo. We must reach to each tribe, each property, every corner of the goldfields." "You have said all this before," Hendrik growled, "but you have never told me why, my brother." "I trust you, but the men I have assembled, the impi you bid me build, they look to me and they ask one question. They ask me, why? What is the profit in this thing? What is there for us in the Brotherhood?" "And what do you answer them, my brother?" asked Moses. "I tell them they must be patient." Hendrik scowled. "I do not know the answer, but I look wise as if I do. And if they nag me like children, well then I beat them like children." Moses laughed delightedly, but Hendrik shook his head. "Don't laugh, my brother. I can't go on beating them much longer." Moses clapped his shoulder. "Nor will you have to much longer. But tell me now, Hendrik, what is it you have missed most in the months you have worked at CRC? Hendrik answered, "The feeling of a woman under me." "That you shall have before the night is finished," said Moses. "And what else, my brother?" "The fire of good liquor in my belly, not the weak slop from the company beer hall." "My brother," Moses told him seriously, "you have answered your own question. These are the things that your men will get from the Brotherhood. These are the scraps we will throw our hunting dogs, women and liquor, and of course money. But for those of us at the head of the buffaloes, there will be more, much more." He started the engine of the Ford. The gold-bearing reefs of the Witwatersrand form a sprawling arc 100 kilometres in length. The older properties, such as East Daggerfontein, are in the eastern sector of the arc where the reef originally outcropped. The newer properties are in the west, where the reef dips away sharply to great depth. But like Bleiburruitsicht, these deep mines are enormously rich. All the mines are laid out along this fabulous crescent, surrounded by the urban development which the gold wealth has attracted and fostered. Moses drove the Black Ford southwards, away from the mines and the white man's streets and buildings, and the road they followed quickly narrowed and deteriorated, its surface rutted and riven with potholes and puddles from the last thunderstorm. It lost direction and began to meander, degenerating into a maze of lanes and tracks. The streetlights of the city were left behind them, but out here there was another illumination, the glow of hundreds of wood fires, their orange light muted by their own drifting smoke banks. There was one of these cooking fires in front of each of the shanties of tar paper and old corrugated iron that crowded so closely that there were only narrow lanes between them. And there was amongst the shacks a feeling of the presence of many unseen people, as though an army were encamped out here in the open veldt. "Where are we?" Hendrik asked. "We are in a city that no man acknowledges, a city of people who do not exist," said Moses. Hendrik glimpsed their dark shapes as the Ford bumped and pitched over the rough track between the shanties and shacks, and the headlights swung aimlessly back and forth, illuminating little cameo scenes. A group of black children stoning a pyra dog. A body lying beside the track, dead or drunk. A woman squatting to urinate in the angle of one of the corrugated iron walls. Two men locked in silent, deadly combat. A family at one of the fires eating from tins of bully beef, their eyes huge and shining as they looked up startled into the headlights. And other dark shapes, scurrying furtively away into the shadows. Hundreds of them, and the presence of thousands more sensed. "This is Drake's Farm," Moses told him, "one of the squatter townships that surround the white man's Goldie." The odour of the amorphous, sprawling aggregation of humanity was wood smoke and sewage, old sweat on hot bodies, and charred food on the open wood fires. It was the smell of garbage mouldering in the rain puddles, and the nauseating sweetness of blood-sucking vermin in unwashed bedding. "How many live here?" asked Hendrik. 5,000? 10,000? Nobody knows. Nobody cares." Moses stopped the Ford and switched off the headlights and the engine. The silence afterwards was not truly silence. It was the murmur of multitudes, like the sea heard at a distance, the mewling of infants, the barking of a cur-dog, the sounds of a woman singing, of men cursing and talking and eating, of couples arguing shrilly or copulating, of people dying and defecating and snoring and gambling and drinking in the night. Moses stepped out of the ford and called imperatively into the darkness, and half a dozen dark figures came scurrying from amongst the shacks. They were children, Hendrik realized, though their age and sex were obscure. "Stand guard on my motor car," Moses ordered, and tossed a small coin that twinkled in the firelight until one of the children snatched it from the air. "Ehey, Baba," they squeaked, and Moses led his brother amongst the shacks for 100 yards, and the sound of the women singing was louder, a thrilling, evocative sound, and there was the buzz of many other voices, and the sour smell of old stale alcohol, and meat cooking on an open fire. They had reached a long, low building, a rough shed cobbled together from discarded material. Its walls were crooked, and the outline of the roof was buckled and sway-backed against the fire glow. Moses knocked upon the door, and a lantern was flashed in his face before the door was thrown open. "So, my brother," Moses took Hendrik's arm and drew him into the doorway, "this is your first shebeen. Here you will have all that I promised you, women and liquor, your fill of both." The shed was packed with human beings, jammed so tightly that the far wall was lost in the fog of blue tobacco smoke, and a man must shout to be heard a few feet away. The black faces shone with sweat and excitement. The men were miners, drinking and singing and laughing and groping the women. Some were very drunk, and a few had fallen to the earth floor and lay in their own vomit. The women were of every tribe, all of their faces painted in the fashion of white women, dressed in flimsy, gaudy dresses, singing and dancing and shaking their hips, picking out the men with money and tugging them away through the doors at the back of the shed. Moses did not have to force his way through this jam of bodies. It opened almost miraculously before him, and many of the women called to him respectfully. Hendrik followed closely behind his brother, and he was struck with admiration that Moses had been able to achieve this degree of recognition in the 3 short months since they had arrived on the Rand. There was a guard at the door at the far end of the shebeen, an ugly, scar-faced ruffian, but he also recognized Moses and clapped his hands in greeting before he pulled aside the canvas screen to allow them to go through into the back room.